Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Edward Snowden's bombshell revelations about the National Security Agency's massive spying program led to the largest leak of classified information in U.S. history and sparked a national debate about privacy, technology, and democracy. The NSA's secret program began in the aftermath of September 11th, when the Bush administration embarked on a secret mission to turn the NSA's attention inward. The new two-part Frontline documentary series, United States of Secrets, reveals the inside story of how the U.S. government came to monitor and collect the communications of millions of Americans. Last Tuesday, the first part of the documentary explored the origins of the secret NSA program, and you can watch that online. And the second part, which airs tonight, explores the relationship between Silicon Valley and the NSA. It airs tonight on PBS stations across the country at 10 p.m. So how was this massive domestic surveillance dragnet conceived? Whatever happened to the people who tried to warn Americans about this surveillance program long before Edward Snowden's revelations? And now that we have all of this information, what can we do as concerned citizens? Where do we go from here? And what is the state of this program? Today, we're joined by Martin Smith, an award-winning veteran correspondent and producer of the two-part Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets. He's also founder of Rain Media, an independent documentary production company based in New York City, and he joins us from his office in New York. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Well, it's really good to have you. You know, we've done so many shows over the past year on the surveillance program and privacy. But what I really liked about this two-part series is that it put everything into context, and it also explored the history. And I'm wondering, because there's been so much media attention, what gaps did you try to fill in this series?
Well, I think it is often the case that these stories that sort of percolate through the news, and you get little snippets here and there and some longer pieces, are not quite collected and synthesized and put together, you know, where people could, even in the absence of new information, could make new realizations about how things work. And that is our job as journalists, to try to help people understand how the world is actually working, who's doing what to whom. So while there is new information in some of what we've done, a lot of it is simply a matter of putting together known events so that you can understand just exactly what the government has been doing and what the private sector has been doing and how the two have worked together, both wittingly and unwittingly.
When you stood back to think about the people that you wanted to interview, the information that you wanted to include, I mean, there have been thousands of media reports written about this issue. Talk a little bit about that process. How did you decide where to really put your focus? Because the first series is 2 hours, which is fairly long, and then tonight's is about an hour.
Yeah, my colleague Michael Kirk was responsible for putting together the, and his team was responsible for putting together those first 2 hours. I can speak more to the tonight's program, which looks at the Silicon Valley NSA relationship. I mean, I'll say a little bit about the first 2 hours. I mean, that's simply tracing the history of how the legal political decision-making process unfolded after 9/11, and just who was behind it, and you know, who was worried about privacy violations, and who pushed to go ahead. So it's a pretty straightforward process of simply collecting all the players and getting them to agree to sit down and speak. And, you know, he did, Mike Kirk and his team did a remarkable job of getting participation from a wide array of people, both inside and outside government, journalists who know the story as well as people on the inside of the NSA or the White House executive branch. In the second part, the final hour that is running tonight, I had assumed that for all the complaining we heard out of Silicon Valley about how they were being bamboozled and their data was being siphoned away without their knowledge, I had assumed that they would participate in the program. And I was it was an education for me, because I've worked on a lot of stories over the years, but I hadn't had an entire industry. It wasn't one company, but the entire industry stonewall and say they're not going to participate. And I think, you know, it doesn't serve the public well that they wouldn't speak. So that was a surprise. And if you talk about gaps, you know, that's a big one. On the other hand, there are former employees who spoke, and so I think you still get a pretty good picture of just what was going on. But unfortunately, Google, Facebook, you know, all these companies decided not to participate.
I mean, these are the companies that are just down the road from us. And so when you contacted them to talk about this, and I assume that obviously you work for Frontline, so it's much easier for you to get people on camera than some, you know, other reporters or media outlets. But what did they say? Just flat out no, not even any written statements?
They were very shy. They said, well, who else is talking to you? And I said, well, I'm hoping you will. And they said, well, who's committed? And when I couldn't put that card on the table, we actually had some indication early on that one of the companies was going to speak to us. And even when I said that we have a company that has agreed, they wanted not to be first into the pool. And so they all just stayed out. You know, I made the case that their side of the story should be told through them, not through others or not through ex-employees, and that it wasn't in their best interest to stay out. I impressed upon them the participation of people in Washington at the NSA, in the executive branch, and they still stayed out. And I find it remarkable because these are companies, as you know well, that depend on the trust of their users and depend and talk a lot about transparency and talk a lot about you know, trust and privacy. And for them not to participate really was dumbfounding to me.
Well, you spoke to a former Google employee. You spoke to professors, former NSA employees. What really struck you the most? Because we just did a show recently about privacy and how, for the most part, unless you go to very great lengths, Julia Angwin, a former reporter with the Wall Street Journal, spent about a year trying to remain private, and she even couldn't do it, and that was her mission for the year. So it's really hard for the average person to do it. But you know, you can use browsers that don't follow you. But what really struck you the most? I mean, you have people in your documentary saying, quote, the FBI loves Facebook because so many of us share such personal information. Google makes a staggering amount of money tracking you when you go on the web. I mean, they were just amazed when they learned that when you search for something, even innocuous, like I'm going to Mendocino for the weekend, they can send you all of these ads for hotels in Mendocino, which makes them so much money. And then the NSA is piggybacking on Google's technology that tracks the users. When you did all this research, what did you walk away with? What you know, when you go to bed at night, what do you still think about?
Well, I guess the first revelation for me was getting it through my head that these companies that offer all these cool services that I'm as addicted to as anybody else, that essentially they are advertising companies. 95% or so of Google's revenue comes from advertising. They say they want to get away from that. But the whole model of Silicon Valley, it used to be in the 90s that you wanted to get onto the Internet, you went to a CompuServe store or something and you bought a web browser from, a Netscape web browser, and you went home and put it on there. That all went away with the advertising model that really monetized the Internet. Before that, everybody in Silicon Valley was scratching their heads. They knew they had something interesting, but they didn't know how to make money out of it. What really surprised me was how pervasive advertising model was and how all the products that are rolled out are now judged by how much revenue they can generate through advertising. And that sort of shifted my understanding of how things worked. I also didn't understand, perhaps naively, just that when you use Gmail, that the content of your email is being surveilled. And this sort of realization, and a lot of people out there know this, of course, in your part of the world particularly, that advertising requires surveillance. It's a kind of surveillance. It's commercial surveillance, but it is surveillance nevertheless. And then I was surprised by how much the NSA was simply coming in and using tracking cookies, for instance, to track a person's browsing history, or to inject malware into their computer and read their keystrokes and capture their passwords by using essentially what has been developed for commercial uses.
The other thing that was striking is that people in the documentary said that there's a race to build the best database. There's like a data war going on. And in order for these companies to win, they have to have the most data possible. So if it's okay for these technology companies to track us 24/7, why isn't it okay for the U.S. government to piggyback on that? I mean, those were the questions that were raised. And that's really fascinating. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that is, if a court knows that that Google is, or Facebook is surveilling their customers, it's hard for them to keep out the government. We have what's called the Fourth Amendment, which, you know, is to prevent unlawful search and seizure of private information. But once you give up information to Yahoo or AOL to deliver an email, it's as if you've written a postcard. And it's third-party doctrine, it's called, whereby if you give it over to somebody else to deliver it, then you've given over your privacy rights. And this has not been tested in the courts in the Internet era to any large degree. We now have more information being collected than ever before, and the laws that we have on the books are not really written with all this with all this in mind. So we're applying old laws to a new world. We're in the early stages of the Internet, and so much information now is collected about us and is given up through third-party doctrine to another person, say it's Yahoo or Microsoft, and therefore they have it, the government can get it.
Martin Smith is an award-winning veteran correspondent and producer of Part 2 of the Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets. It looks at the very close relationship between Silicon Valley and the NSA, and it airs tonight at 10 o'clock on PBS stations. Last Tuesday, explored the origins of the secret NSA program and the history of it, and you can watch that right now online. You can find links at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions for Martin about this Frontline series, which does a really good job of providing context and really connecting all of the dots, because we've done so many shows about the NSA program, spying program, and sometimes have a hard time because there's just so much information out there. And Frontline did a really good job of connecting the dots. So if you have questions for Martin about this piece, and what role do you think a show like Frontline can really do to help people understand what all of this information actually means to all of us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And then also, now that we have all of this information, what can we do as concerned citizens? Where do we go from here? And what's in store for the future of these programs? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Martin, doing all of this research, interviewing all of these people, I should also say that, again, not one technology company agreed to go on the record. How did it change the way you interact with technology?
That's an interesting question. I immediately got off of everything. I met with Julia Angwin, you mentioned her before, who's written the book Dragnet Nation, former reporter with the Wall Street Journal and now with ProPublica, doing investigative reporting in this field. And I tried to really extract or myself from all this connectivity. But then as I worked on it, I became more curious about how it worked, and using myself as a guinea pig, I tiptoed back in to the pool to see what kind of ads would follow me and to just try to understand exactly how all this was working and affecting my experience on the Internet. I got to say that, you know, advertising isn't a problem, that somebody's following me around on the Internet and and advertising something to me that they have figured out that I might be interested in. It doesn't bother me that much. It's maybe an annoyance. I don't think it bothers most people. And the question here is, what access to that technology can an outsider have? We just heard the story yesterday that broke about the five Chinese military officers who were indicted by the Justice Department for hacking into the companies' emails and other data. Hackers, foreign governments, our own government can all get inside this advertising ecosystem in the case of, you know, users, or they can just break into people's emails as the Chinese are alleged to have done. So, you know, it affected me. I certainly think about it much more. I don't right now have a Twitter account and not on Facebook, and I was before.
Well, we'd also love to hear from you if you've got, we have a caller who's got a friend who worked at the NSA. If you have friends who work for the government, or if you do, or if you work for a tech company, we'd love to hear from you on these issues. And of course, you can remain anonymous. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hello,
you,
Mark.
For having me. Yes.
There you are. Hi, Mark.
Just wanted to say that I thought it was interesting. I had a friend working with, the NSA and one of the big, large tech companies, and he was kind of an intern, and I thought it was really interesting. A lot of the people that he worked with were also ex-lobbyists from the Bush administration now that are, high up in some of the big tech companies. So I thought it was pretty transparent and kind of, you know, a little terrifying, so I'd like to say hi to the NSA right now as well.
Martin, what are your thoughts on that? The
revolving
door.
I don't quite understand, Mark. You said that his friend worked inside a tech company but was working for the NSA. I didn't quite understand that.
Exactly. Yeah. So he was actually not part of the NSA. Some of his other interns that he worked with were working for the NSA, but inside of the big tech company. So
that's very interesting. That's very interesting.
Also, the biggest lobbyist for one of the Bush administration is head of one of the biggest tech companies now at this time. So
that's very interesting.
That's probably why it's hard to get some response from the tech companies.
Well, you know, my understanding was that when these companies receive requests from either the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court or from the FBI through a national security letter, that very few people inside these companies were privy to the knowledge that the company was getting a government request. And that way, most of the people inside the large tech companies did not know that their data, their users' data, was being requested and handed over, and that when the news broke that, for instance, they were receiving tens of thousands of these national security letters requesting data, that most people inside the tech industry were shocked that this was going on.
Well, you have a section in part two of the Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets. The Washington Post reporter Barton Gellman had a story about PRISM, and these were documents showing how, beginning in 2007, nine companies cooperated with the NSA, including Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, and YouTube, which is now owned by Google. And Barton Gellman said that the U.S. government asked him not to publish the names of the companies. Do not do this. And then once he did, the timing was so strange and interesting because President Obama was actually on a fundraising trip to Silicon Valley.
Yes, you caught that. That's very good.
Yeah.
That was a coincidence that he happened to be in Silicon Valley when that news broke and had to answer questions, although he didn't allow many questions at that point. But that gives you an indication. The fact that the NSA requested that the names of those companies not be released gives you an indication of how toxic this could be for Silicon Valley. Again, these companies depend on the trust of their users, and especially overseas, where they expect there to be growth for their markets. The U.S. is a sort of mature market. They're not getting new users. Everybody's already using them. But overseas, they rely on these people trusting them with their data. And if the news got out that the internet companies were providing this information to the government, they were worried that the companies would cease cooperation, would fight back, and whatnot. Gelman was interested in not publishing anything that would jeopardize U.S. National security, but the Post and Gelman decided that the publication of these names was people's right to know what was going on, and so they went ahead and published it. And, of course, it was a big storm in Silicon Valley when that news came out.
Mm. Well, and also what's another interesting part of the documentary is when the tech companies met with the president at his request to talk about the healthcare website and how he could improve it, they completely changed the conversation and said, no, we want to talk about what's going on with the NSA because our image is at stake here. So what should we citizens who use all of these websites and social media sites think of these tech companies at a time when they're refusing to respond? I mean, should we assume that the people at the very top are, in fact, cooperating with the NSA?
Well, look, I mean, I think that there's a reason for telecommunication companies, internet companies, to cooperate to some degree with government when they have legitimate requests for information on a target. There's nothing odd about that. The question is how sweeping, how large, how much of dragnet surveillance or bulk data collection is going on here. Nobody that I talk to in the privacy sphere objects to a court-ordered warrant going to a company and having that company respond if they feel that it is a legitimate court-ordered, you know, above-board request. But all this was done in secrecy. And the question is whether or not how much of this secrecy is really necessary, and how broad do these requests have to be? So that goes to the heart of just, you know, where have we gotten to, and do we need to pull this back a bit or a lot?
The other interesting point made by Tim Wu, who teaches at Columbia and focuses on technology, is that AT&T has been cooperating with the government for decades. That's not, so he said he wasn't surprised by that at all. But the new internet companies at least have to look like they don't want to cooperate with something like this.
Well, they have a sort of a libertarian roots. And they don't want to be seen as cozying up to government, especially when, as I pointed out, their growth markets are all overseas. So they want to be very careful about their image. And so they were very upset that these articles came out. Not only that, it was not simply PRISM that they were upset about it being exposed. But there was a backdoor effort to tap into overseas data lines.
And hold that thought, Martin. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll talk about the efforts to tap in overseas. Martin Smith is an award-winning veteran correspondent and producer of Part 2 of the Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets. It airs tonight on PBS at 10, looking at the close relationship between the NSA and Silicon Valley. You can watch the first part of the documentary, looking at the origins of the secret NSA program, online. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a program that relies on engaged listeners. Join us. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Or you can post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 in 30 minutes, BBC's World Have Your Say. Today, what's going on in Thailand? The army there is on the streets and has declared martial law, but the chief of the army insists it's not a coup. Also, China and the U.S. are in a tit-for-tat blame game over cyber spying. That's coming up on the BBC's World Have Your Say at 11 o'clock.
This This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about how the public defense system is working. It's been more than half a century since the Supreme Court ruled that every defendant in a criminal case deserves legal representation, even if they can't afford it. So many public defenders say they are overworked and underpaid. How is this affecting the justice system and what needs to change? That's tomorrow. And if you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about Frontline's new two-part documentary series, United States of Secrets. It reveals the inside story of how the U.S. government came to monitor and collect the communications of millions of Americans. Last Tuesday was part one, and it explored the origins of the secret NSA program going back to the Bush administration, and you can watch that online. The second part airs tonight on PBS at 10 o'clock p.m. and explores the close relationship between Silicon Valley and the NSA. And we're joined today by Martin Smith. He produced part two, and he's an award-winning veteran correspondent of Frontline. He's also founder of Rain Media, an independent documentary production company based in New York. And Martin did reach out to all of the major Silicon Valley companies like Facebook, Yahoo, and Google, and they all refused to go on the record. So if you work in high tech, we'd love to hear from you. What conversations are you all having about the secret program and the connection with the NSA's violations of privacy? What are your thoughts on this? And do you, people in the company have misgivings about the role that these companies have played since 9/11? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you have a question for Martin about what he found and explored in the Frontline Part 2 documentary series, United States of Secrets, we'd also love to hear from you. So before we get to calls, Martin, you wanted to talk to us about how the government is going through the back door overseas. Can you first kind of explain how that works?
Yeah, sure. As I said, PRISM was a sort of a front door operation where you'd come to the company and request information and they'd throw it in a Dropbox or give you a thumb drive or however they would do it, depending on the company. Muscular revelations were of overseas tapping into data lines running between the data centers of Google and Yahoo. And these were lines that Google had gone out and rented lines that they thought were secure, specific lines that they would put not only user data, but their own proprietary data that had to, you know, their special sauce of how to run their programs. Overseas, the government isn't restricted by U.S. surveillance laws in the same way it is here, and so they just tapped into this. And this contains millions of users' information flowing over these lines. You know, the whole internet is one big unitary system whereby everything is syncing up all the time, so that when you make a keystroke here, it travels, you know, not only to your home computer, to your work computer, to your mobile device, but it syncs up with the data centers, so you have a whole big redundant system. So that means if you tap in overseas, you can get a lot of information not only of foreign targets, which the law says they're supposed to be looking at only foreign terrorist targets, but it picks up millions of American records. They did this without the company's knowledge. This felt like a betrayal. This was, as Eric Schmidt of Google said, you know, they didn't write, they didn't knock, they just walked right in and they took.
Well, let's hear from Richard calling from Silicon Valley. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. What I wanted to ask you, Martin, is a lot of users have gone to Tor, the Onion router, to bounce traffic between servers around the world to mask their communication. And Tor noticed about a 30% increase in Tor servers, which they couldn't initially explain. And they theorized that perhaps the NSA and FBI were setting up a whole bunch of servers to try to tap into that network as well. Did you find any evidence that that might be happening?
I did not. It's a very interesting question that you raise. And it is a constant cat-and-mouse game. What we do know is that after the Muscular revelations that I was just talking about, where they were tapping overseas data lines, that Google and Yahoo and others have increased their use of encryption. The government has countered with trying to develop a quantum computer that will break all known forms of encryption. So it doesn't surprise me that something like what you're speculating and that Tor is noticing might be the result of NSA or FBI activity, but I'm sorry, I can't speak to that specifically.
And if you want more information on this, Tor says that it prevents people from learning your location or browsing habits, and you can find information at Tor, T-O-R, project.org. And Martin, because you know all of this information has been revealed and there's been outrage and all of that, what is the relationship today? I mean, maybe it's hard for you to know because the Silicon Valley companies refuse to talk to you, but what's the relationship today between these corporations and the U.S. government?
You know, I very much wanted to know what was said in the White House when the executives came to talk to the president about healthcare.gov, and they turned the conversation to talking about the NSA's activities, their complaints about being blindsided. It was just that week, a few days before that meeting, that a story broke about how their advertising cookies, their tracking cookies, were being piggybacked on by the NSA. So they had a lot to bring to the table, but we don't know what was said in that meeting. And that would give us a clue as to exactly what the nature of the relationship is right now. This is a healthy sector of the economy, as we all know. And for it to take a hit because of what's been revealed and losing markets overseas and losing the trust of users is a major faux pas on the part of the NSA and the administration. You do not want to take the healthiest part of your economy and bang it up like this. This is why Zuckerberg famously said after these revelations that the government blew it on surveillance. As Stuart Baker, a former NSA and Homeland Security official, told us in the program, unfortunately, we didn't plan our programs on the assumption that they would be exposed. But unfortunately, we live in the information era, and these things do get out.
Well, thank you for calling in, Richard. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you again for this wonderful show, Rose.
Thank you.
And Martin, thank you for the Frontline program. I'm going to say out loud what you already know, and that is when businesses, or particularly big business, won't talk to you, you're really on to something.
That is a lesson you learn in this business, I'm afraid, yes.
Absolutely. And I'm reading a wonderful book called The Burglary. It talks about some brave anti-war activists in the Vietnam era who broke into FBI offices and came away with documents showing the invasion of privacy of the FBI into anti-war groups' activities in order to intimidate them and disrupt them. And as a result of that, the FBI was forbidden from doing those sorts of activities, and which were open to the public. Anybody can go in, or anybody could join these groups if they wanted to. And it seems like we have a similar situation with the Internet. Although it's open to the public, I don't think government should be sticking their nose into what we're doing unless they have a sufficient reason to do so and obtain a warrant. And I'd like to get your thinking on that.
Well, I think I'm glad you raised the point outlined in the book, because we have very short memories when it comes to history, and I think we have to remind ourselves over and over again that when there are these data troves, they can be abused. They can be used for blackmail. We know about Martin Luther King being blackmailed by J. Edgar Hoover, but there are many more cases that that don't involve celebrities, if you will, that where people's rights have been abused, where people have been wrongly accused of things, and abuses have taken place by law enforcement or by intelligence agencies. And so it's good to remind ourselves of the fact that there are consequences by having the government having free sort of access to all of this. And what the discussion now is about is to whether or not we need to pull back and decrease the amount of secrecy. Now, I think the government has a job to do in terms of keeping us safe, and I don't want to see those protect. I don't want to see them not do that their job. The question is whether or not they need to collect everything in order to be able to figure out who is out there to hurt us. That's the question.
Well, and since you talked about history, I just want to play a clip from part one of the PBS Frontline documentary series, United States of Secrets. And this really does look at the history. It looks at what happened under Nixon and how the NSA spied on Americans. The domestic spying apparatus, for the most part, went dark for 25 years. It was against the law to turn the NSA on Americans. And then, of course, everything changed on September 11th, 2001. And the spying program was known simply as the program. And in this clip, you will hear Alberto Gonzalez, White House counsel from 2001 to 2005, and Peter Baker, a reporter with the New York Times.
Almost immediately, Cheney directed his lawyer, David Addington, to prepare the case for the president to exercise his unilateral authority as commander-in-chief.
David Addington, principal of the vice president, was interested in ensuring that the president's constitutional authority was used to its fullest.
Cheney says, I want you to tell me what powers we're going to need, the president's going to need, that he doesn't already have to respond to this calamity.
And they decide that they're going to push every boundary they have. Addington at one point says, we're going to push and push and push until some larger force makes us stop.
Tours of the Capitol will be canceled indefinitely.
FBI has received 4,000 reports of bombs and fire.
On September 12th at NSA headquarters, the mood was somber.
Question, where did it all begin?
We began soul-searching almost immediately. We all felt like a great wrong had been done and that we were all somewhat, if not all, culpable.
A state which will live in infamy.
You have to remember that NSA was created after World War II to prevent another surprise attack. That was the whole raison d'etre for NSA. Pearl Harbor, we don't want another Pearl Harbor.
Information that more people involved in the plot remain in the United States.
Immediately, we began to wonder what we had done wrong. Why did we miss the boat? What didn't we detect that we should have detected?
And that is a clip from the Frontline documentary series, United States of Secrets, the part one, which you can watch online. And what's really interesting about this, Martin, I'm so glad you revisit history, because I'm not sure most people realize that this program, there was a secret signing with Dick Cheney on October 1st, 2001. The order was written by David Addington, Cheney's lawyer, not the Bush lawyer, which is unique in the history of U.S. intelligence operations.
That's right.
And this was also stored in David Addington's safe, one of the most closely kept secrets of the Bush-Cheney administration for 4 years. In fact, most people in the White House didn't even know about it.
Well, that's right. And the premise of all of this is that collecting everything will make us safer. And that's the question that we have to grapple with now, is to whether or not collecting everything about everybody with no seeming limits is really addressing the problem that we face, the threat of a terrorist attack. Is that really going to bury us in so much information that we won't be able to find our way to the corner? But it's premised on the idea that you collect it all. That's written in many of the documents, and that you're then able to search the haystack to find the proverbial needle.
The other question is, can this happen again? I mean, can you have an administration in the future that comes up with some kind of program that's only, or that's drummed up by a very small group of people, without even having members of the inner circle knowing about it?
Well, we had people on Capitol Hill briefed about this. They are our elected representatives, as is the president. And that didn't seem to prevent these programs from being instituted without the broader knowledge of the American public. And it isn't... it's interesting because we... use some clips of President Bush talking about the Patriot Act at the signing of the Patriot Act and some subsequent speeches. back there in 2001, and he pretty much lays out in his speech that we're going to engage in surveilling emails and all sorts of electronic communications. When you go back and listen to him speak then, you realize what he was talking about, and the what we didn't know was the extent of it, and it also corresponded with the birth of the Internet. You know, really, the Internet doesn't take off. I mean, Facebook doesn't even exist until you get to 2006, 2007, at least off the campuses that it started from. So you had this sort of interesting confluence of the government's rising appetite for information and the growth of the digital revolution and the growth of Internet data troves. All kind of fell together.
How did the Obama administration initially react to the era of mass surveillance under Bush? And do you think that the administration made any significant changes?
There's no evidence that I know of that Obama has pulled back until, you know, he recently got the report of his review panel after the Snowden revelations and now is proposing some changes. During his campaign for the presidency, of course, he campaigned against secrecy. I mean, you have to remember that there were whistleblowers. Mm. There was some evidence. We profile one AT&T technician who blew the whistle back in 2005 when he went public about witnessing secret surveillance. There were other people inside the NSA who resigned soon after 9/11 because they thought what was going on was unconstitutional and too broad. But we didn't really know, we didn't have documentation until Snowden. During the campaign, Obama's presidential campaign, his first one, he did say that we need to rein in secret operations and surveillance. There was enough out there, that there was enough of an issue. But when he gets into the White House, it's, I guess, very sobering when he's told that if you do this, you risk another terrorist attack on our soil. For one reason or another, I wasn't there, I wasn't a fly on the wall. He made the decision to carry forward with the same programs.
Well, the other interesting tidbit you reveal in the second documentary is that Edward Snowden was watching testimony from General James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, basically saying that the NSA does not wittingly collect information on millions of Americans. And Glenn Greenwald tells you that for Snowden, the final testimony was the final nail in the coffin, and that's what got Edward Snowden to release all the documents.
And I believe Snowden, yes, he said so to Greenwald, that seeing that testimony while he was in Hawaii, where he was an NSA contractor, was the final straw. To see General Clapper go before the committee on the Hill and say, he was asked by Senator Wyden whether or not the NSA was collecting millions of records of ordinary Americans, and he says no. And then he sort of scratches his head. He looks very nervous. He's looking down. And then he says, not wittingly. And this was too much for Snowden, who had access to so many classified documents that proved the opposite. So that's when he decided to go public.
You know, the other thing I forgot, when Snowden went to Moscow, he was actually on his way to South America.
There's a lot of debate about this to whether or not he was already, by the time he got on the flight to Moscow, whether or not his passport had been revoked. But he did apparently tell Greenwald and Gelman, as far as I understand it, that that was his intent, was to get to Ecuador or Bolivia or someplace that would give him asylum. But once, by the time he got to Moscow, his passport had been revoked. He couldn't get on a plane, and he was advised by a number of people, including apparently Julian Assange, to stay in Moscow, that was a better chance for him than trying to go anywhere else. Hmm.
Martin Smith is producer of the Part 2 Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets. It airs tonight on PBS at 10 o'clock p.m. You can watch Part 1 online. You can find the link at yourcallradio.org. And you can give us a call if you'd like to ask Martin any questions about this series, what he found. What are your thoughts on all of these revelations? What changes have you made? Where do you think this is going? And if you work in the tech industry, because not one technology company agreed to sit down with Martin for the series, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear your insights. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Jeff in Berkeley. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
This is something that Mr. Smith and I followed his work for years. I mean, it's really excellent. It may be his next project, Barrett Brown Stratcor. Barrett Brown exposed one tiny link to what Stratcor was doing, and he's evidently been in jail for over a year. He's essentially a whistleblower. But the next side of this, you're talking consumer records being dumped to the NSA. The people that work for NSA or CIA spill over to Stratcor and a number of other companies, and then what they do is they spy on American and foreign businesses. Well, this is a massive race to the bottom. All my experience has been in corporate America, most of it as a management consultant. And, you know, there is no privacy on secret matters, competitive matters between companies when you can hire NSA operatives that used to work that are working for Stratcor. All right, you know the rest of it. Any comments on that? And I'll take my question or my answers off the air.
Thank you. Isn't it Strat4 with an F?
Yeah, let me pull it up. I'm looking at the computer screen.
Strat4, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He knows what it is.
Martin, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I only know the bare outlines. My head's been buried in this in the center of this NSA story for the last 6 months or more. But I will say, you know, you say it's a race to the bottom. I mean, all of this, all of what you do online can get to the hands of government, can get to the hands of a hacker, can get to the hands of a private company. And what people had known about all of this for a long time or suspected it, but they were sort of seen as being paranoid, as being part of the tinfoil hat brigade. And until Snowden came out with the documentation that showed the extent and depth of these programs, it wasn't until then that many of these people that were discredited as paranoids were vindicated. So now we're having a conversation that we should likely have had, or in my opinion have had many years ago, about just how far in democracy do we want to go, and just how do we plug the holes? I mean, as the caller points out, that there is all of these various contractors of various kinds with various interests digging into information that all of us have put up online, or that companies have online. It's all very porous. We're in the early stages of the Internet. It's time for us to sort of assess how we can make this work for us and not against us.
Well, and what can the average citizen do about this? Because it's really hard, and most of us don't want to disconnect from social media because it adds so much value to our lives.
It does. I think for most people, look, if you think that you don't have anything that is going to embarrass you, or can be used against you, maybe it's okay. It is very hard to disconnect, as you pointed out. You mentioned Tor. I've used Tor. I've used other protections, privacy protection. As a journalist with sources, I have to be more aware of what a breach of my privacy or my conversations with the source might reveal and might cause harm to somebody. So I have to be a little more careful. I have to say I find it very difficult to use these systems. Snowden contacted Glenn Greenwald of The Guardian, and Greenwald thought he was a nut and didn't set up his own encrypted encryption and almost missed the biggest scoop of any journalist in the last 100 years.
Yeah, that was another revelation in the documentary. I didn't know that Greenwald actually ignored the emails, thinking, I hear from so many people, I'm not going to take this guy seriously.
Exactly.
And then when he contacted Laura Poitras, she then reached out to Greenwald. And it was also interesting, I'm probably giving away so much here, but definitely see the documentary tonight. But the Washington Post reporter Bob, I'm looking for his name, Barton Gellman, he actually didn't go to Hong Kong with Laura because he thought it might be a little dangerous or maybe Snowden wasn't telling the truth.
I don't think that Bart has really fully explained why he didn't go, but I think he probably regrets it at this point, but I don't know for sure.
So Greenwald really owes a huge thanks to Laura Poitras. I don't think she gets enough credit at all.
Well, Laura's a filmmaker. She's making her own documentary, and for reasons of her own, she decided not to sit for an interview with Frontline, and so therefore it was very hard to include more from her about her in the documentary.
Hmm. So, Martin, we have about a minute left. Where does this go from here? I mean, as a journalist who takes on these big issues and really puts them into context, what is next with this story?
Well, I think we're still at the early stages of having this conversation. I think that there's more potentially to come from these documents, but I don't know myself exactly what. They're very technical, some of them, and it's very hard to sort out what's aspirational and what's actually operational in the documents. But I think that a lot of the conversation has to happen just south of you there in Silicon Valley about providing better protections. Privacy policies are written in such a way that they can change them without notice if you read them carefully.
Right.
Nobody does. They're in size 3 font, and the accept button is always in size 12. But there you go.
And I have to tell you, I was watching last week's series online, and it said, I will have higher quality streaming if I sign in via Facebook on the Frontline website, which I thought was hilarious watching this documentary.
Yeah, we're all collecting information on
that's right. Well, thank
however we can.
Martin Smith, thank you so much for joining us. Martin is producer of part 2 of the Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you, Rose. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How is the public defense system working? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with public defenders about representing the poor. It's been more than half a century since the Supreme Court ruled that every defendant in a criminal case deserves legal representation, even if they can't pay for it. Many public defenders say they're overworked and underpaid. So how is this affecting the justice system, and what needs to change? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.